Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Friday, President Obama laid out a stark scenario for the American people. The situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan, he said, is increasingly perilous. The war that has raged for 7 years is headed in the wrong direction. And so, his plan, more troops, more advisors, more diplomacy, much more aid to both countries. This hour, On Point, the Obama plan for the war in Afghanistan and for Pakistan. You can join the conversation. Are you with the president on this war? On the AFPAC challenge, do we have a choice? We'll hear how President Obama's plan is being debated in Washington in a moment, but we begin in Kabul, Afghanistan. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson is Afghanistan Bureau Chief for National Public Radio. She joins us from the Afghan capital. Thanks very much for being with us.
Anytime, Tom.
Tell us about the response. The president makes a big speech. It's been signaled that everybody knew it was coming for a long time, but now the details are there and his language is there. Did people listen live? And what kind of response have you been hearing there in Kabul?
Well, it came fairly late in the evening on the equivalent of what is a Sunday evening here, so I'm not sure how many people actually watched it at home. Certainly it was being carried live on some satellite channels, and you were able to see it if you wanted to. But the reception has been overwhelmingly positive this far. I think it was perhaps a little bit surprising. We thought there would at least be some reaction from the presidential palace questioning some of the items because, quite frankly, the relationship between Mr. Obama and Mr. Karzai has not necessarily been congenial the way it was with the previous administration. But the Afghan president quickly held a press conference the next morning. That certainly was carried live, and he laid out point by point and said that his administration is completely supportive and that the plan is better than they were even expecting.
Does it feel like a big change from Afghanistan, Saraya? President Obama's laying it out as a new day, his plan, his way, a new focus, he says. But in its elements, does it feel like a big change there?
Well, I think the biggest change that people are happy about is that the attention will now be focused on Afghanistan, on Pakistan, on the regional issues here, and that we are deviating or moving away from looking at Iraq as being our main center of focus. And I think that's the thing that heartens people here the most, because there is certainly a strong sentiment among people and officials here that the reason Afghanistan has gone downhill is because there wasn't enough American attention here in the last 7 years.
The military had asked for more troops than this. Now we're talking, of course, 17,000 combat troops will be on their way to Afghanistan, new troops in addition to the 38,000, 4,000 military trainers. What are you hearing from U.S. military in Afghanistan? Do they feel this is a big enough increase in their presence there, less than they had hoped for? What are the implications of the numbers that President Obama is providing?
Well, I've most recently spent time with American trainers of border police. Of course, the border is perhaps the most difficult area as well besides the south. But the border leads to why the south is insecure in large part. I mean, you have basically Al-Qaeda and Taliban and all various militant groups hanging out in this very porous, mountainous area that's very difficult to contain. And so there's been certainly a severe shortage of trainers for those troops. For the Afghan troops, that is. And the feeling among American military and also the NATO partners here is that this needs to be an Afghan solution, and the best way to do that, in their estimation, is to build up the Afghan army and Afghan police. So they were very welcoming of the 4,000 more trainers that they're going to be getting. There is some debate about whether it goes to the army and then you backdoor it to the police, because certainly in Mr. Obama's speech and in some of the talking points, the feeling is that the EU should be involved more with the police training. And realistically, I mean, the Americans are going to have to do it. So there was a lot of warm reception on that part. In terms of trying to militarily win this, I mean, I think it's clear, certainly from the strategy and also here on the ground, the feeling is that it can't be won militarily and that there has to be more emphasis on reconstruction and development and beefing up the Afghan capacity. And certainly what they're lacking in troops, at least in the current plan, or as it stands right now, is certainly made up for, in at least people's minds here, with the stronger emphasis on those civilian factors.
And, of course, the Taliban strength has been growing, especially in the south, maybe near where you were, Saraya. And then news today, 8 people dying in a suicide bomb attack on a police compound just 10 miles or so south of Kandahar City, a stronghold of the Taliban in that area. Is this indicative of the kind of growing Taliban strength and problem that the U.S. and Afghan forces are up against?
Certainly, this is a very much an insurgents war. They're using a lot of tactics to scare people and to sort of drive a wedge between the Afghan people and their government. And because a lot of these areas, it's a very difficult terrain here. In many ways, Iraq was easier in that sense because the terrain is just not as mountainous and porous without any decent roads. And you have to just picture one mountain, one valley after another, and it becomes impossible to really hold any area for any length of time unless you have massive amounts of troops. And so yes, I mean, that is very indicative of the problem they face here. Certainly, suicide attacks, roadside bombs, all these sorts of things are on the rise. The Taliban and other militant groups here are very much in favor of sort of launching an attack. I mean, they don't do really traditional warfare the way that the military perhaps is used to it. What they like to do is launch an attack on Western troops and then run and hide, you know, seek cover in a village, basically, trying to create civilian casualties, which, of course, has become a really dicey issue here. And so it is very indicative of what the troops here face and why, perhaps militarily, this is a very difficult war to win.
Saraya Sahardi-Nelson, Afghanistan Bureau Chief for National Public Radio, joining us from Kabul. Saraya, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Last Friday, President Obama marched to the podium, flanked by Defense Secretary Bob Gates, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and the rest of his national security team. Before he laid out his new plan, he laid out the problem, speaking, as he put it, clearly and candidly to the American people.
Al-Qaeda and its allies, the terrorists who planned and supported the 9/11 attacks, are in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Multiple intelligence estimates have warned that Al-Qaeda is actively planning attacks on the United States homeland from its safe haven in Pakistan. And if the Afghan government falls to the Taliban or allows Al-Qaeda to go unchallenged, that country will again be a base for terrorists who want to kill as many of our people as they possibly can.
President Obama on Friday. We're talking today about the Obama plan for the war in Afghanistan and for Pakistan. Joining me now, first from Washington, Christopher Preble, Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, author of the new book out today, The Power Problem, How American Military Dominance Makes Us Less Safe, Less Prosperous, and Less Free. Christopher Preble, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. My pleasure.
And with us from Gig Harbor, Washington, Thomas Donnelly is here. He's a defense and security policy analyst at the American Enterprise Institute, author with Frederick Kagan of Ground Truth, The Future of U.S. Land Power. Thomas Donnelly, thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be with you, Tom.
Give us your top-of-mind response to the president's plans laid out on Friday, Tom Donnelly. What do you make of this? More than a vision here, we're getting down to details.
Well, overall, I'd say it's an important step. As Christopher is well aware and all Washington is well aware, there was pretty vigorous debate within the administration about which way they were going to go. And despite the emphasis that candidate Obama placed on Afghanistan during the campaign, it wasn't altogether clear that there was really going to be such a substantial commitment to pushing forward in Afghanistan. So all in all, or at least from my perspective, the glass is more than half full. It's not completely full, but considering what the alternatives might have been and about which there was a lot of talk over mm-hmm. the last couple of weeks, mm-hmm. I'd say I'm pretty pleased by what the president said.
You, from your perspective, might have looked for more troops. We'll talk about that perspective and that desire. Christopher Preble, what about the debate inside the administration? This was an interesting speech that came packaged in news of a pretty fierce back and forth on the approach that ought to be taken here. How do you read, what were the sides, and how do you read who won here, Chris?
Well, I think that there was a tension inside the administration reflecting a tension inside the Washington policy community more generally. Mm-hmm. between a focus on counterterrorism or a broader nation-building objective in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I think the president, frankly, split the baby a little bit and did not fall victim to choosing an either-or.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, the direction that he is going to take is shaped by the goals he set forth. And the goals he set forth, I think, were actually quite focused, appropriately focused. He led off by talking about al-Qaeda and over the weekend has talked about al-Qaeda over and over and over again, about the counterterrorism mission, which would imply that the counterterrorism-focused people had prevailed in this internal debate. The signal that the counterinsurgency folks have prevailed will only come if the president substantially, very substantially, increases the number of troops in Afghanistan. And what he signaled on Friday was not, frankly, a very large increase in troops. It was not consistent with a classic counterinsurgency strategy, which would require, like I said, many, many more troops than we're talking about, even with the increases that have been programmed and that will be implemented over the next few months.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Obama plan for the war in Afghanistan and for Pakistan, the AFPAC challenge, as it has come to be called. The president speaking Friday on his plans for more troops, more money, more focus, above all, on this war, this theater. I'm joined by Christopher Preble from the Cato Institute, author of the new book, The Power Problem, How American Military Dominance Makes Us Less Safe, Less Prosperous, and Less Free, and from the American Enterprise Institute by Thomas Donnelly, defense and security policy analyst there, author with Frederick Kagan of Ground Truth, The Future of U.S. Land Power. I want to get a sense of where each of you are coming from on this. Tom Donnelly, back in 2002, you were one of those, along with Richard Pearl and Rich Lowry, Bill Bennett, and others, who signed a letter to President Bush saying, let's go into Iraq, kind of the neocon letter it came to be known as from the New American Century. Are you taking a neoconservative view of Afghanistan, Tom, or how do you describe your starting point on this one?
Well, it's hard for me to disavow my paper trail, which is long and large. But I don't think you have to be particularly a neocon to, first of all, understand how the United States got into Afghanistan. But I think it's also the case that In the years since the invasion, immediately following the 9/11 attacks, and because of the success of those attacks, that our goals have changed. One of the things that makes me nervous that is that President Obama so talks about this, both in the campaign and in his speech the other on Friday, as the central front in the war on terror. Afghanistan is not. There is very minimal al-Qaeda, as in Osama bin Laden al-Qaeda, presence in Afghanistan proper.
But this is his Afghanistan plan, and he's made al-Qaeda his focus, Tom.
Pardon?
But this is his Afghanistan-Pakistan plan, and as Chris Preble was saying, he's made al-Qaeda the centerpiece.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But it's very... it is somewhat misleading. If your focus is al-Qaeda, then Pakistan and not just the Northwest Frontier or the tribal areas, but other parts of Pakistan, mainland settler areas of Pakistan, are now really where the fight against the global jihad is. That's the central front in that conflict. I do believe we need to succeed in Afghanistan to have any hopes of succeeding in our goals in Pakistan, which include the al-Qaeda issue, but are larger anyway. So the war is quite different than the war that the president described. So there's disconnect between what the sort of public rationale for what we're doing and the actual military rationale. And I think that often becomes a tension. People will turn around a year from now, probably not thinking that the war against Al-Qaeda is really very much different than it is today, and ask themselves, why did we deploy 17,000 or 22,000 more Americans to Afghanistan?
Chris, Christopher, I want to come to your big perspective on this, but let's listen to the president. It's not as though he gave Pakistan short shrift on Friday, as if the vast mountains of Afghanistan weren't enough of a challenge. He said that Pakistan and the Al-Qaeda leadership that's hunkered down there poses the greater and more daunting challenge.
In the nearly 8 years since 9/11, Al-Qaeda and its extremist allies have moved across the border to the remote areas of the Pakistani frontier. This almost certainly includes Al-Qaeda's leadership, Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri. They have used this mountainous terrain as a safe haven to hide, to train terrorists, to communicate with followers, to plot attacks, and to send fighters to support the insurgency in Afghanistan. For the American people, this border region has become the most dangerous place in the world.
Christopher Preble, what do you make of that analysis? And give us a sense of how you come at this. You're at the Libertarian Cato Institute, but your book is The Power Problem, How American Military Dominance Makes Us Less Safe. Are you straight up opposed to military involvement in this area? Do you see this as more American empire building, or are you with the president's analysis that we have to be here militarily?
No, I think that the exceptions that was posed by Afghanistan, by the Taliban actively harboring Al-Qaeda prior to 9/11, and their obvious unwillingness to cooperate with the United States even after, the attacks on the embassies in Africa in 1998, there was a clear decision on the part of the Taliban to provide aid and comfort to Al-Qaeda, and ultimately the Taliban paid a heavy price, correctly, and that price was delivered by military force. But I think that, and I stress this point in my book, that many of the successes that we've scored against Al-Qaeda since 9/11 have not been scored primarily by military means. And if you focus just on the Afghan case, if you focus just on what our U.S. military accomplished in the first few months after we went into Afghanistan, I submit that we accomplished many of the goals that the president says are still our core goals today. One, to significantly degrade Al-Qaeda's capability, which we did, to dislodge the Taliban from power, which we did, and thirdly, very importantly, to send a message to any other government in the world that to repeat the mistake that the Taliban made, they would pay a very, very heavy price. But beyond those very specific goals and the goals that we continue, much of the successes that we've scored have not been military. Use the example of the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib, the two self-described masterminds of the 9/11 attacks. Neither of them, of course, were captured in Afghanistan. They were both captured in Pakistan, and they were captured not by military personnel, but by U.S. law enforcement cooperating with Pakistani officials.
But a lot of this is getting to be years back now. 7 years ago, U.S. troops first went in, and what we heard more recently, Christopher Preble, is Taliban gains all over the place, especially in the south. Al-Qaeda gains, for that matter, and Taliban gains in Pakistan. Does that mean that this new push is appropriate by your lights, or not otherwise?
I think that it was important for the president to restate the focus of the mission in Afghanistan, and it was equally important for him to stress Pakistan. And indeed, I think it makes sense for us to refer to an Afghan-Pakistan challenge, or simply AFPAC, as you've seen a lot of the white papers prepared by the White House and distributed. That's what we're talking about here. The difference, of course, is that there is a functioning government in Pakistan, a weak government, but a functioning government, with a very strong military, of course, stronger than many militaries around the world, and probably stronger than we'd like relative to the strength of the democratic government there. But they do have the capacity to deal with the security problems inside of the territory if they had the will to do so. It's a much harder thing to convince them to do so. On the side of Afghanistan, obviously there has to be much more work done into building up the Afghan National Army. But here again, I think the president's focus was an appropriate one. It was not on doing the fight for the Afghans, but in helping and training the Afghans to build up security personnel so that they'll be able to do those fights themselves. And again, that's a broader theme of my own work, is that the United States can continue to fight other people's wars for them, or as I think we're moving in the direction of helping other countries do more to defend themselves and to play a responsible role in their respective neighborhoods and move away from the notion that the United States and the United States alone is the only country on the planet that is capable of preventing this kind of chaos and violence around the world.
Though Americans have learned from long experience to look with some skepticism on training operations and know very well from history that they can turn into, greatly larger American troop presence. Let me get our listeners in here from Ithaca, New York, if I may. Chris, you're on the air.
Chris Bershot is my name. My experience has been limited to the tribal areas of Pakistan, but I have been a student of the Pashtun people. This is a cultural critique of where Obama has made a mistake, and, of course, the previous administration, too. The Taliban is really a Pashtun social movement to adjust or try to correct injustices that they've seen. And there have been two focuses. One, anti-U.S., especially on the Afghan side. Remember, we're talking about 38 million people here in the tribal areas on both sides of the border. And on the Pakistani side, these people in these districts, or agencies as they're properly called, in the Fatah, this federally administered tribal area, have been denied representation in the Pakistani government, and the Pakistani government, read other people, such as the Punjabis, have taken advantage of those areas.
So Chris, take us to the nub of your observation. Do you think President Obama is wrong to see the Taliban and al-Qaeda as a related problem?
Furthermore, has driven the two sides, the two parts of the Taliban, into one solidarity movement, and furthermore, they have caused them to reach out for resources from the Saudis and others. And remember this, some of those districts or agencies, 22% of the families have people living in the Gulf states sending home remittances from abroad.
We got it. Thanks for your call, Chris. Tom Donnelly, what about it? We've got the Taliban, we've got al-Qaeda. The president calls al-Qaeda his number one target. Above all, Chris says he's not persuaded, that they're fundamentally on in the same patch here, though events may have thrown them together. How do you look at these two today?
Well, but they do have distinct political goals. And the caller, I think, actually started a very good discussion.
Mm-hmm,
here. Mm-hmm. Just to expand on the caller's comments, it's also the case that the Pashtun majority in Afghanistan has been a problem for the state of Afghanistan. The Taliban, to call it a Pashtun national movement is a little bit too simplistic, I would say. But at any rate, it has put other Afghans, particularly the Tajik and Uzbek populations, very much on edge. Those two ethnic groups formed the famous Northern Alliance that was our partner in our original invasion and had fought the Taliban and Pashtun warlords during the very ugly civil war that followed the Soviet withdrawal. Secondly, Chris from Ithaca was right to focus on the problem of the Punjabi majority in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
My own view is that the problem with Pakistan is as though we're looking through the wrong end of the telescope when we look at Pakistan. What's problematic about Pakistan is the normal order of business, and particularly including the army, which Chris Preble said quite rightly is way too strong for a normal, decent, functioning state. It's often said that Pakistan is an army with a state, not a state with an army. And our problem as Americans is that we haven't really followed through in understanding the logic of Pakistan, so we reach for convenient answers, most often generals like General Musharraf, if there is ever going to be anything like stability or a region that we can live in South Asia, the central problem is establishing the rule of law and a decent civil government in Pakistan.
Talk about a giant sounding challenge. That's a big one right there. Let's hear from a caller who may know something about exactly that challenge from Montreal in Canada. Farouk is calling. Hi, Farouk. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Okay, thank you for taking the call. Mm-hmm. Here's what I'd like to say. I'm originally from Pakistan. I am closely in touch with what's going on there.
Okay.
I completely support the aim of President Obama's aim of rooting out al-Qaeda and denying sanctuaries there, and that's why the Taliban are relevant, because the Taliban themselves aren't terrorist organizations per se in terms of attacking Western interests, but they provide sanctuary to their extremist views and so on. But my big question is that I believe that it's not going to succeed. This war or this goal of rooting out al-Qaeda and denying sanctuaries isn't going to succeed till the average general Pakistanis are convinced that this is their fight and it's in their interest to do so. And I think right. that is the biggest challenge, and I'm certainly not seeing enough. I know that President Obama in his speech said, well, this is a cancer for Pakistani society and so on, but I'll tell you quickly if I can three things. That the general population, led by a right-wing media, very much the Fox News of Pakistan, and there's plenty of them over there, will say things like this. Well, it's a U.S. war. The U.S. started it, and if the U.S. leaves Afghanistan, things will be back to normal. Everything was fine before September 11. The U.S. came in, and that's destabilized the region. So it's not our business. Secondly, people will say, well, you know, it's everything that's going on. For example, this morning, some terrorists went in and blew up a police training academy, killing 30, 40 people.
Yeah.
What will most people say and the government tell them? The government of Pakistan will tell them, well, it must be foreign hands. It must be India or, you know, allude to God knows Mossad or whatever, because the government by Zardari or whoever else is itself quite incompetent, can't face up to the truth. And so it'll kind of lull people into thinking, look, we're a victim country, we're besieged by everybody, and so nobody owns up to it. So till the general, all this leaves the average person is very confused, very, you know, uncertain of what the hell's going on, and they're looking everywhere except within their midst and without acknowledging that really this problem's metastasized. I mean, the left-leaning progressive newspapers, the Pakistanis you'll find at Ivy League universities in the U.S., they'll own up to this and they'll recognize it, but the general population does not.
Farouk, let us pick it up right here. Chris Preble, what do you say?
Well, I think the caller raises a number of really good points. And getting back to what Tom Donnelly said, I mean, he and I agree that the Bush administration in particular, their strong support of General Musharraf was short-sighted and not indicative of a medium to long-term strategy. We should not be providing blanket support to, frankly, any Pakistani leader, military or civilian, if they don't show an ability to deal with this problem, which is why I think it's so important. The president on Friday stressed benchmarks. And I think that's going to be a very important criteria going forward. What are those benchmarks? What do we do if the Pakistani government or separately the Afghan government does not meet those benchmarks? But the other point I want to stress, and the caller raised it indirectly at least, is part of the reason why the Pakistanis, and here I think it applies both to the military and the civilian population in general, don't see the problem in the frontier provinces as their fight is because Pakistan continues to be very heavily focused on India, which is, in fact, their existential threat, the country that they fought several bloody wars with. And they continue, the military in particular, continues to be much more focused on India than they are on the problems in the West. And I think that that's why a regional strategy has to bring India into this conversation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Obama plan for the war in Afghanistan and for Pakistan, the AFPAC Challenge, it is now being called. We've been joined from Gig Harbor, Washington, by Thomas Donnelly, defense and security policy analyst at the American Enterprise Institute. And from the Cato Institute, Christopher Preble is with us. Let's listen to the president on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday morning saying that the previous administration had lost focus on America's greatest security threat, al-Qaeda, while toppling Saddam Hussein and rebuilding Iraq.
The focus over the last 7 years, I think, has been lost. What we want to do is to refocus attention on al-Qaeda. We are going to root out their networks, their bases. We are going to make sure that they cannot attack U.S. citizens, U.S. soil, U.S. interests, and our allies' interests around the world.
Face the Nation host Bob Schieffer asked President Obama whether more foreign troops in Afghanistan would be welcomed or resented as foreign occupiers. The president said this can work, yes, but boots on the ground, he's acknowledged, can backfire, said he knows the lessons of Vietnam.
Are you concerned at all? Because some people say the more troops you put in, it's just going to inflame the situation. It's going to make it worse. Yes. What do you say to them?
Well, I'm very mindful of that. Look, I'm enough of a student of history to know that the United States in Vietnam and other countries in other epochs of history have overextended to the point where they were severely weakened.
The president saying he knows the history of Vietnam. Let's get a call from Lowell, Massachusetts, and Rhonda. Rhonda, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I've got various family members and friends that have been involved in the military in Afghanistan, Iraq, and have had actual contact with the children and the families there. And the Afghanistan people, as well as the Iraqi people, they were willing to help the soldiers there and the Americans, but they had to be very careful because if they didn't do it carefully as far as getting information and that to the soldiers, they would see their loved ones killed in front of them, or the families would disappear, any number of things. And there was a very strong urge among the Afghanistani people where my family member was stationed at to want to bring this whole thing to an end, to make a better life for themselves, and to rid the area of the terrorists and the support for the terrorists. Going to Pakistan and the whole history with Syria and what we know or suspect as far as assistance to Al-Qaeda, the links to the Taliban and to Osama bin Laden, we know by the very facts and the acts that they have done that there is support there for them, whether it be wide out in the open or underground.
Rhonda, you've got military family then. Are you heartened by the president's plan or not?
Yes. The family member was there before and is due to go back there shortly, and I very much support what he's doing. I think he's playing it smart. I think he's going to gather his information. He's going to take his education, and he's going to look at all aspects, and I don't think he's going to just run in there blind and not have a good plan, because I think he realizes from the past years what we have accomplished, what we have not accomplished, where we have failed, and where we have succeeded.
Let's hope so. Rhonda, thank you for your call. Tom Donnelly, how about it? Americans of a certain generation, I think, probably can't help but see a young president in office, you know, with a huge domestic agenda. And now here we are talking about sending more troops and military advisors. Obama says he's learned the lessons of Vietnam, but you know, has he really? Do they pertain here, Tom Donnelly? Is there a quagmire risk?
Well, Tom, I think the most vivid lesson, as I read the Obama administration, is not a lesson about the nature of irregular warfare, but it's about how a war like this can divert a president from his domestic policy priorities. So I think. When Obama thinks about, or his lieutenants think about Vietnam in this context, they are worried that, as Lyndon Baines Johnson was diverted from the Great Society programs by the war in Vietnam, they are determined not to be determined from their domestic policy agenda.
They may be determined, but so was LBJ, and you've said a year from now this war may look harder. I think you wanted more troops, Tom Donnelly. Do you think?
I did, and so did the commanders on the ground. However, one of the sort of questions unanswered by the president on Friday is whether he's really, you know, Christopher mentioned the benchmarks.
Yeah.
In recent memory, and particularly in the case of Iraq, benchmarks were essentially a way to measure the underperformance of Iraq. Mm-hmm. So we had an excuse for withdrawal. I'm not sure that President Obama's commitment, particularly if in a year from now it doesn't look, and I don't think there will have been, a decisive kind of change of fortune as there was after the Iraq surge in such a short period of time, It'd be interesting to see whether the White House and the President are willing to continue. Time is more important than numbers per se, and I think also Chris noted that this was a little bit of a halfway commitment. There, I mean, there was as much to note about things that were missing from the President's speech on Friday. So my bottom line would be, so far so good, but he's basically kicked the can down the road a year, and we're going to be in a similar set of circumstances about a year from now.
Chris Preble, how about it? Benchmarks suggest leverage, and the leverage in Iraq, I guess here as well, is, well, we could leave. Can the U.S. leave here? And what about Tom Donnelly's observation that there's some kicking the can down the road? You know, maybe they sort of split the baby between limited counterterror action and a more broad nation-building counterinsurgency. Is it a compromise that you think can work, Chris? Chris Preble? Sounds like we may have lost him for a moment there. Let's get a call from Buffalo, New York. Prasad, you're on the air, Prasad.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I am an Indian, and I've been observing the way President Obama has been making different steps, especially towards his approach towards history. And it's sort of interesting to note that around 30 years ago, America decided to get involved in Pakistan and Afghanistan. There was a military government at that time in Pakistan, which eventually was replaced by a democratically elected one. And at that time, America decided to withdraw. I'm talking about the origins of the Mujahideen and, you know, the monstering into Taliban and Al-Qaeda. So for me, when I look at this, this is more like a deja vu.
Going all the way back to U.S. support for the Mujahideen in the time of Soviet occupation, but you know, this time it's U.S. troops and NATO troops that are in Afghanistan. Where's the deja vu, Prasad?
It is the way the situation of Pakistan and, of course, Afghanistan appears to have remained status quo. But Pakistan going through being unstable, going through a military government which had come through a coup, and then back to democracy and. We've just gone through the same steps in Pakistan right now, with Musharraf then being replaced by Benazir Bhutto's widow.
Tom Donnelly, what about it? $1.5 billion a year for Pakistan in this plan. Do you think that can buy greater Pakistani cooperation? There were many billion put in under George W. Bush, and still the impression that the United States has quite half-hearted cooperation in Pakistan, Tom.
Well, the caller is correct. The presumption in Islamabad has been not only since the end of the Afghan-Soviet War, but really going back to the very first days of Pakistan, was that eventually the United States would lose interest and go away, and Pakistan would be left on its own. And that explains, and unfortunately, a lot of the paranoid behavior that Pakistan has exhibited. I think that's wrong. I think it's particularly dangerous in a world where India is becoming a global great power and that the United States is in Afghanistan, I think, on one level or another for the duration. So the regional strategic facts have really changed for Pakistan, but they have yet to internalize or think through what that means. And are also reluctant to do so because that would mean a profound change in the role of the Pakistani army and Pakistani society, and that might be the most upsetting. And I think that is the thing that the Pakistani army fears much more than certainly a war with India or terrorists within its borders, because that would be a threat to the domestic political order.
Chris Preble in Washington, do we have you back there?
Yes, I'm back. Thanks, Tom.
Good. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, I mean, in this whole debate that went on in crafting this policy, as Tom Donnelly says, the U.S. military, or some elements there wanted more, substantially
right.
more troops. Vice President Biden reportedly wanted less U.S. footprint here.
Right.
Does the compromise look to you Like kicking the can down the road, like something that can really work here? Is President Obama putting off a day of reckoning? You know, it's easy to sort of make commitments early in a presidency, as George Bush saw, can get awfully hairy along the way sticking with them.
Right. Well, I obviously hope not, and I think that, again, I disagree with Tom Donnelly a little bit on the question of benchmarks. I don't think benchmarks are just an excuse for withdrawal. I think benchmarks can and should be a measure whereby you change your approach if you don't accomplish your core objectives. And I think that for too long we've been giving a blank check, certainly to the Pakistani government and to a lesser extent to the Afghan government, and I think that the president's right to stress the importance of you know, accountability. But going back to one other quick point, you know, I was less than one year old at the time of the Tet Offensive. I wish the president didn't have to refer to the history of Vietnam. How about the history of Iraq? Because when you talk about boots on the ground, you talk about how people react to having potentially tens of thousands of American forces on their soil. We saw in Iraq that the advocates for war said we would be welcomed as liberators, and that was not the case. And so I think the president is correct in trying to stress the training and support for Afghan forces rather than U.S. forces doing the fight for the Afghans. Again, we adopted that approach in Iraq after many years of you know, hard lessons, and I think that the lesson in Iraq applied to Afghanistan is to not do with our hands what the Afghans should do themselves.
Let's get a call from West Hartford, Connecticut, and Joshua. Joshua, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Basically, more broadly, my question is sort of involved with how they might plan or what might be a good way of transitioning from Iraq into a surge in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And then more specifically, it seems that we've spent a lot of time training our troops in urban warfare, urban combat techniques, and I wonder how much more time might need to be spent to sort of switch them over to the more mountainous and rugged terrain that is in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I will take my answer off the air.
Good question. Thank you, Josh. Tom Donnelly, I know we have to let you go in a minute. What about it? First of all, do you see this as a transition from Iraq to Afghanistan, Pakistan? And what about all that training that's gone on for, you know, fighting in Sadr City and urban warfare? Is it relevant here?
Short answer is yes. I mean, the reason that I'm talking to you from Gig Harbor, Washington, is I'm out here to brief an army unit, a striker unit, in other words, a mounted combat unit that's about to deploy to Afghanistan, help them prepare for what they're going to face. And I would just so far report that these guys are actually quite savvy about the situation that they're going to be deployed into. And, in fact, they're going to be initially deployed in and around Kabul, which is a pretty sizable city. Just as kind of a military proposition, is not quite that different from Sadr City. You don't have the great big broad avenues that you have in Iraq. But this is actually we're increasing the strain on our land forces here. We're withdrawing from Iraq slowly and surging in Afghanistan, and the net result is that more soldiers are deployed and will be deployed this year than during the surge year in Iraq. They'll be in different places, but from a soldier's perspective, he's got plenty of work to do.
Well, good luck briefing them there in Washington State. Tom Donnelly with the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks for being with us this hour, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
Christopher Preble, we just got a minute here. You know, our caller asks about transitioning from Iraq and the surge in Afghanistan. What do you make of this language? And I mean, is there another approach? Could we be approaching this differently? You know, your new book is all about American military dominance making us less safe. Is there some alternative that we're not looking at here?
Right. Two quick points. To Tom Donnelly's point that the military is under strain, I don't disagree with that at all. In fact, the key theme in my book is that if we were to restructure our military without changing our underlying strategy, it would be worse than doing nothing at all, because the burdens would be felt by the U.S. military, as they were in the 1990s when we cut the military but we gave them more missions. The issue is, what do we expect our military to be doing? And I think that's where we need to focus more on capable allies, allies that are able to step forward and defend themselves and play a meaningful role in their environment. The other quick point I'd like to make is about transitioning from Iraq to Afghanistan. These two places could not be more different. Just on the point of urban warfare and the concentration in urban centers, 1 in 4 Iraqis live in Baghdad. 1 in 4, 25% of the population of Iraq in one city, Baghdad. In Afghanistan, 10% of the Afghan population lives in the 5 largest cities. So in other words, 90% of the population is completely rural.
And I know that countryside, it is as rugged as it gets.
So my point is that when we talk about applying the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan, my message is be careful. These two countries are very, very different, and you cannot simply map one over to the other.
We've got a few seconds here, but a year down the road, do you see progress from this, or Tom Donnelly warns it's going to be a bigger requirements, more
progress? The progress for me, very simple, is how many Afghan units are capable of operating on their own, and are they transitioning to a more self-reliant and less reliant on the United States? That's the key metric for me, and that's what I'll be watching very carefully over the next year.
Chris Preble at the Cato Institute, author of The Power Problem. Christopher Preble, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.